talk this evening, Buddhist Ceremony Teacher of the Many Traditions, is based on this book here, which you'll have in your library soon. You can check it out and read it. You can also get a copy of it. But it's a book that I co-authored with his holiness the Dalai Lama. And the reason that the book was written was his holiness feels that he has a lot of contact with people from other religions. He does a lot of interfaith dialogue with Muslims and Christians and Hindus and Jews and all sorts of other people. But he says he doesn't have nearly as much contact with people from other Buddhist traditions. And, you know, traditionally, Buddhism, you know, as we know, has spread from its homeland in India in all directions. And until last century, it was very rare for people in one Buddhist tradition to meet people in other Buddhist traditions because we didn't have modern transportation. We didn't have Skype and email. We didn't have telephones. So it was hard for people in different traditions to meet each other. And as a result, people being disconnected, what you have is different stereotypes or different misconceptions about other Buddhist traditions being passed down from generation to generation. And people just believe these stereotypes and misconceptions because they've never met anybody from the other traditions who could explain, you know, that those things were true. So, and I saw this for myself because I first encountered Buddhism in Los Angeles, where I lived, and since there weren't many temples or centers there where I could learn Buddhism in English at that time, this was 1971, I immediately went to Asia, to Nepal and India. And I stayed there for many years, studying with the Tibetan Buddhist community in exile. They had, in 1959, tens of thousands of Tibetans led into India from Tibet after a Chinese communist invasion of their country. And so I would have just stayed in the Tibetan community, studied with them. I really didn't know anything about the Buddhist traditions. I hardly knew that there were others. But at one point, 1987 it must have been, my teacher asked me to go to Singapore and to teach there. And so I went to Singapore. I knew one person when I went. And then learning about Singapore, I had never been there, I didn't know what it was like. And what I found was that there were Buddhists of all different traditions there. There were Theravada Buddhists from Thailand, from Sri Lanka, from Burma. You know, there were Chinese Buddhists, some practicing Zen or Chan, some practicing Burma. There were different Tibetan Buddhists, not so many in that time, but a couple of other centers. And then there was the general folk culture of Singapore, where many people were going to mediums and practicing Taoism and doing ancestor worship. And so I learned a whole lot in this very, very different environment with so many different Buddhist traditions. And that's when I learned about how Paul loss of these stereotypes, right? And also the kind of stereotypes that people have about my tradition, Tibetan Buddhist tradition. So along that line, I remember one time taking a walk in Sequoia Park, and a man stopped me, and he said, "Can you tell me my lucky number for the lottery?" And I said, "I have no idea. I don't do that kind of thing." And he said, "But you practice Tibetan Buddhism, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Well, I thought that all the people did things like that." And I said, "No, they don't." And I realized, that he had this image of Tibetan Buddhism as, doing fortune telling. That's what it did. I also remember one time when I was in America going to speak at a university, and one of the students raised their hand. It was in a religion class. They had just gotten done reading the textbook about Buddhism. And he raised his hand and he said, "I heard that Tibetan Buddhists practice magic. Tell me about it." "What?" I said, "No, Tibetan Buddhists do not practice magic. Where did you hear that?" "Oh, I read it in our college textbook." I said, "Your college textbook is wrong. We do not practice magic." Then some other people, hear, especially in this part of the world, they hear about Tantra. And, one time when I was in Hong Kong, a man he offered lunch time. And we were talking, after the meal, and he said, "Oh, do you practice Tantra? Do you practice sexual Tantra?" And I'm going, "Get me out of here really quick. I don't trust this guy." And he had totally the wrong idea that Tibetan Buddhists, practice sex and got drunk. And I'm going, "Wait a minute. There's the door." Because I did not trust his intentions. And then all of that made me recall misunderstandings that I heard about other Buddhist traditions. Like the Theravadas are selfish. Yeah, we heard that one. They want to become arhats. They aren't seeking full Buddhahood, so they're all selfish. Well, when I lived in Singapore, I had relationships with many Theravada monks. They were all very kind, and they certainly weren't selfish. Then I had heard that in Chinese Buddhism, they all do blank-minded meditation, remove taking all thoughts out of their mind and just meditating on nothingness. But I met Chinese Buddhists when I was in Singapore, and also I attended a panel, a conversation by Master Shen Yang from Dharma Drum Institute. He passed away a few years ago, and his only was the Dalai Lama. And I learned that no, Chinese Buddhists do not practice like-minded meditation. So it really made me see all these misconceptions that people have about each other's traditions. And His Holiness, of course, sees that too. And he says, he's commenting, damaging that is, not only to us as individuals, but it damages our ability to work in a united way for peace in the world. Because if we don't understand other Buddhist traditions, we have wrong conceptions about them, and we criticize them, then how are we ever going to work together to deal with the bigger problems of the world, such as climate change, racism, violations of human rights, things that are really important to the world? And so this holiness wants the Buddhists from different traditions to come together in this way, because our basic tenets are the same. We have the same teacher. We're all Buddhists. We have the same teacher. Our basic tenets, our basic practices, our basic beliefs are all the same. So we need to come together and work together. At the same time, you know, different traditions do emphasize different practices. They may approach different topics in a slightly different way. So we don't have to say that everything is exactly the same. We can respect the differences in traditions, because when you study all the scriptures, you see that from time to time, the Buddha said different things to different people. Sometimes, for example, to some people, he may have even said that there is a self. And then to other people, he said, there's no permanent self. And to other people, he said, there's no substantially existent self. And to another group, he said, there's no inherently existent self. Now, if you just look at the words like this, you say, wait a minute, what does the Buddha really believe? He said different things to different people. Well, the Buddha, whenever he gave teachings, was addressing the needs and concerns and the level of practice and the interests of that specific audience. So according to the dispositions and the interests of different audiences, because you know the Buddha walked all around northern India, years. You know, everybody has different personalities. Different groups have different interests and dispositions and aspirations. And so the Buddha, being a very skillful teacher, he said different things to different groups according to what that group needed to hear at that particular time. So somebody may say, well, then was he lying? Because he didn't say exactly the same thing. And the answer is no, of course not. The Buddha would never lie. He's a skillful teacher. So he said he explained things in ways that different people could understand. So it's kind of like us, yeah? When you meet different people, let's say of different ages and different generations, do you explain things differently because these people are different ages and different generations and they've had different life experiences? Yeah, you do, don't you? You tailor your talk to the audience. For young people, you have to say things in a certain way to even get them to pay attention to you. And they have to have a lot of life experience, so you have to really explain things in a different way. Somebody who's older, who's had many life experiences, they may understand things much quicker. So you don't need to go into all the specific details, because, you know, they're already, mentally developed. in a way that maybe young people aren't.
Okay?
So, in the same way, the Buddha taught different sentient beings different things. And it was all done, of course, with motivation of compassion and the motivation to eventually lead everybody to liberation and to full awakening. So it's very important that we understand this. And I found that in helping to prepare this book for disclosing this, I did a lot of research on the Theravada tradition and also on Chinese Buddhism. And I could say from my own experience that that really affected my own Dharma practice, because I found real gems in these other traditions that complemented what I had learned in my own tradition, in Tibetan Buddhism. And these points were maybe said in a slightly different way, but because they were approached from a different angle and with different words, it really helped me understand things in a new way that I hadn't understood before. And so, in doing the research in this book, I really saw so clearly what a skillful teacher the Buddha was, and how he taught things, different things to different people, so that everybody could find something that made sense to them, that helped them. And so this also reinforces what my Tibetan teachers have been saying for many years, which is that we should never criticize other Buddhist traditions, because they come from the same teacher, the Buddha. If we criticize the other traditions, it's like criticizing the Buddha. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't want to create the karma of criticizing the Buddha, because clearly the Buddha is my object of refuge. Clearly, he knows much more than I do. He's fully awake. You know, I'm not. So rather than judge or deprecate any teaching the Buddha gave, you know, I'd much rather be open-minded and say, oh, you know, look, it suits somebody's mentality, and that's really good. And if I can listen to it, I might learn something that I didn't know before. So, when we wrote the book, we decided to talk about the similarities and differences in the doctrine, in the teachings of the different Buddhist traditions. Even though, of course, we couldn't discuss every single Buddhist tradition, because even within the different branches, there's different traditions. Okay? Within Tibetan Buddhism, you have Nyingma, Kargyur, and Lhasa. Within Theravada Buddhism, you have people that say, practice shamatha first. Other people who say practice vipassana first. A third group that says practice the two together. Okay? You have different ways of practicing vinaya among the different traditions. In Chinese Buddhism, which is also practiced in Vietnam and Korea and other places, some people do a lot of chanting, some people do a lot of silent chant meditation. So, of course, we couldn't discuss every single tradition, but we tried to take the general points from some of the major ones. And like I said, instead of discussing the superficial points, we went into the doctrine to show that how it's similar and how it's different. But first, I want to talk a little bit about some of the superficial points, because sometimes that the superficial differences can cause people a lot of anxiety and a lot of misunderstanding. Okay. So, for example, in Theravada countries, when you go into a temple, the climate is usually very hot. So it's open, like this temple is, and a high ceiling, and the altar is usually very simple. If you go into a Tibetan temple, because Tibet is in a mountainous area, it's cold outside, you don't have all the doors open. Yeah, it's darker because you have fewer windows because they didn't have heating in the temples. And the temples are filled with statues and paintings and music, you know, all these musical instruments and brocade. And you go into that temple and there's a lot going on. You go in a Japanese Zen temple, and it's sparse. Everything's black and brown, maybe a few flowers that are colored. Everybody walks very solemnly, you know. And you're kind of going, this doesn't look anything like the Theravada or the Tibetan. Then you go into a Chinese Pure Land temple, and the robes are different than in the Theravada and in the Japanese, and everybody's chanting Namo Amitabha, and then they're doing the serpentine walking, you know, where you follow and you're chanting. And you go, oh my goodness, all these places are so different, what's going on? Okay. They have to see that in some ways the culture and the climate, the geography of the place where Buddhism is, influence how it's practiced. So for example, you know, in Japan, they have the cherry trees, they have a lot of color and nature, they're on the water. There's a lot of things to look at in Japan. If you ever go to Tibet, where you're up above the tree line, you can look for miles and see nothing, not even a tree. So it makes sense that in Japan, where outside the temple there's a lot of color, inside the temple it's going to be rather plain, rather simple. And in Tibetan Buddhism, where the environment has nothing in it, you're going to go into the temple and it's going to be filled with color. Yeah? So you see, you know, just how the environment shapes what the temple looks like. In the Theravada countries, where it was really hot, then the Sangha could go on Pindapath. So they would take their almost bowl into town, stand before a house. If people wanted to offer food, they would put it in the bowl. If they didn't, then the person would go on to the next house and stand silently there. And that was socially acceptable. It was fine. People were delighted to support the Sangha. Yeah, and the Sangha could walk from place to place. In China, what happened is when the Sangha stayed in the cities, that's where the emperor was, all the Chinese bureaucracy, the government had all these things going on in cities and towns. And so it was too distracting for the Sangha. They could easily get caught up in all these political goings on, which they didn't want to. So they moved out of the city. They went high up in the mountains. When you're high up in the mountains, you can't go on Pindapak because there's not so many villages around you. Also, we have, you know, one of our precepts was to not do agriculture. Well, in Theravada countries, that worked very well because, you know, the people, the lay people, did the farming and everything like that. But when the Chinese monastics went into the forest, if they were going to grow food because they lived near a temple, they had to do the farming themselves. So they had to interpret that precept in a different way. In Tibet, very cold climate, and you had a quarter of the male population that were monks, were monks. This was prior to 1959. So you have, outside Lhasa, the capital city, Sera Monastery had over 3,000 monks. Gaudin had over 5,000. Draco had about 10,000 monks. Could you imagine what would happen if all those monks went on to the pot in the town? I mean, the lay people would be totally overwhelmed. There's no way they could cook so much food. Okay? So they developed, and also it was very cold. You know, you couldn't walk a few miles in the snow to go on a Pindapak every day to get your dinner, your lunch. Okay? So they developed a whole different way. And instead, people brought food to the monastery, or sometimes people donated money and asked the monks to buy their own food and cook their own food. And so they did that because that was more convenient for the lay people as well as for the monks. So even today, if you go to Tibetan monasteries, for example, in South India, you will see, and I'm not exaggerating, pots that are this big. They have some of the pots are like 5 or 6 feet in diameter. They're from here to about here. And they'll cook rice in a pot like that. Because they have so many monks to feed. So they have to do things their own way, according to their own monastic system. And so you'll find people will keep precepts in slightly different ways according to their environment and their culture and the economy in the place. In the West, for example, we're setting up Shravasti Abbey. So we live in the middle of nowhere. We're about an hour and a quarter from the city, about 20 minutes from our local town that has one stoplight, so it's not a big town. Yeah, how are we going to go on Pindapak, especially in the winter when it snows? And especially in the West, we have some friends who went on Pindapak in their local town. They had to go to the city council and get a parade permit. Yeah, because when you go on Pindapak, one person is leading and everybody's walking behind them, and the city said you need a permit because we consider that a parade. Ridiculous, isn't it? So, you know, we didn't want to get a parade permit. So, we don't go on Pindapak in our town. But people bring us food, and then we cook. We don't go out and buy our own food. No? So you have to make these kind of adaptations. In terms of our robes, in ancient India, kind of saffron was considered an ugly color. And so that was the color that all the wandering renunciates wore,
because there were many different groups of renunciates at the time of the Buddha.
They all wore rags that were saffron color. Now, you know, that was fine for them. Buddhism goes to China, and there's a law there that only the emperor can wear gold color. So they can't wear saffron in the monasteries, because it's against the law. So they thought in Chinese culture a more suitable color for people who were renunciates would be gray or black. So they changed the color of the robes. They also changed the design of the robes to match some of the people in China during the Tang Dynasty. Then Buddhism goes to Tibet, and they don't have the color dye to make a bright orange saffron color. If you've ever seen threads of saffron, some of it is dark like this. So they did have a color dye that was dark saffron white. So they made all the robes this color. Okay. In ancient India, it was hot, so we weren't supposed to wear sleeves. Yeah. We were supposed to have our arms bare. In China, it was considered risque for the sangha to have their arms bare. So when they changed the color of the robes, they also made them long sleeve. They also sewed them differently because in China, when the first Buddhist monastics came with their rag robes, people thought they were beggars and looked down on them. Now that doesn't help the spread of Buddhism, does it? So they knew, okay, we can't wear rag robes anymore. We have to wear robes that were sewn out of one piece that looked a little bit nicer, so that people don't criticize the Buddhists for being beggars. Okay? So when you see this, you see how things change across cultures. One time in the U.S., every year, the Western Dharma practitioners, but no matter what race they are, we come together once a year to meet and discuss things of mutual interest. One day, during one of these meetings, we had a Buddhist fashion show, quotations, where each tradition explained their robes and how the robes were stitched, and why they were stitched that way. And it was really fascinating, because when we looked very closely, we saw that there was the same pattern of stitching. Maybe the way it was stitched was a little bit different, but you'll see on my robe, there's patches going this way, patches going this way. We found in the robes of all the different traditions, there was just about the same way of patches being sewn. That was so interesting. Even in Japan, you know, they wear the rakushuku, whatever you call it, the thing that goes here. Very small patches they have. Ours are big patches. But it was very interesting because we saw that in all these different traditions, they have preserved the idea of wearing robes made of leftover cloth, different pieces that was being stitched together. So be a stumbling block for you.
When I wanted to change the Chewy ordination, the full ordination for women, they don't have that lineage in Tibetan Buddhism because they never had the requisite number of fully ordained nuns go to Tibet. So when I wanted to receive that ordination, I went to Taiwan. Bhante here went to China. We both took the ordination in the Chinese Buddhist tradition because the Theravada didn't have the ordination for fully ordained nuns, and neither did the Tibetan, but the Chinese did. So, you know, even though, let's say, my practice tradition is Tibetan, my ordination is from the Chinese tradition. I wear Tibetan robes. But when I went to Taiwan for ordination, I wore Chinese robes. When Bhante went to China, she wore Chinese robes. Her tradition is Theravada. When she came back, she wears Theravada robes. But there's no problem in any of this, because all these teachings came from the same teacher, from the Buddha. And the different traditions, you know, again, the style of the robes, the color, and so on. It's just because people choose to do things different ways because of their culture and climate. You may have noticed, too, how we bow. We bow differently, don't we? You may have been surprised when I bow, we bow from standing up. Now we stand up, we go all the way down, we stand up again. When the Chinese bow, you go down, you turn your palms up, you stay down for a moment, then you come back. So it's a little bit different. In Theravada, you start out kneeling, and you bow from the kneeling position. That's the easiest, isn't it? You don't have to get up and down three times. You are already down. But, you know, the purpose of the prostrations is the same, you know, to show respect to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we all take refuge in the same Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. It's not like there's different Buddhas and different Dharmas and different Sanghas that we take refuge in. We do not take refuge in a particular Buddhist tradition. We take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and that's shared by all the Buddhist traditions. Of course, when you go to Thailand, the Buddhas look Thai. When you go to China, the Buddhas look Chinese. When you go to Tibet, the Buddhas look Tibetan. We're still trying to figure out in the West how the Buddhas look, because we have so many different races. But you know, that's just an appearance of the Buddha. Actually, the Buddha was Indian. And so, you know, in many ways, I think he didn't. Everybody, you know, draws the Buddha differently, but the Buddha himself probably didn't look like any of the ways that he's currently drawn. But that's not important, because we're not taking refuge in a painting or a statue. We're not idol worshippers. We're taking refuge in the qualities of an enlightened being, and with the intention of generating those same qualities ourselves. So it's okay if the Buddha looks different. We were talking this afternoon, in Thailand, the Buddha's in the half lotus position. In other traditions, he's in the full lotus position. Actually, in Tibet, we call it the Vajra position, not the lotus position. Does it really matter? The Buddha has a crown protrusion that symbolizes the amazing amount
of merit that he created in order to become fully embodied.
In Thailand, the crown protrusion is pointy. In Tibet, it's round. Does it really matter?
I don't think so.
So, in the book, I want to just share with you some of the topics that we discussed, because I think you may find this interesting. We started the book talking a little bit about Buddhist history, and what I finally come to the conclusion of is each Buddhist tradition has its own version of Buddhist history. So there's some intersecting points and there's some different points. And then these scholars in universities, they have their ideas of Buddhist history. And in fact, none of us really know, because the scriptures that were written were all written like on papyrus and, you know, on bark and leaves. Most of them disintegrate. We don't really even know what language the Buddha spoke. Some people say Pali, some people say Sanskrit. It seems like he may have spoken actually a dialect of Prakrit, which was a language that was known in ancient India. But there were many dialects of Prakrit. So did the Buddha teach, because he went from place to place. So did he know many different dialects? Yeah? Or did he speak Pali? Or did he speak Sanskrit? What in the world did he speak? We don't really even know. We have some guesses, but we don't know. Anyway, the first chapter was about a little bit about the origin of Buddhism and Buddhist history. The second chapter was refuge and how each tradition sees the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we all take refuge in the same three refuges. How we see them, there's a little bit of a difference. Yeah. So some people say the Buddha is omniscient, and all the time he can see everything that exists. Other people say the Buddha is all-knowing, and he has to turn his mind to something, and then he knows. But it comes to the same point, which is whether the Buddha has to turn his mind to it, or it already appears to his mind, the Buddha knows all that exists. Okay? So there's some differences like that. Some traditions say that the Buddha was an ordinary being when he was born and attained awakening in that life. Other traditions say actually he had attained awakening a long time ago and just appeared to be an ordinary being who attained awakening. Okay. So there's some differences like that. I don't think that we have to quarrel about them in any way. Then the third chapter is about the Four Noble Truths. Actually, calling them Four Noble Truths isn't a very good translation. Yeah? Because there's nothing noble about dukkha or suffering. Okay? It should be translated Four Truths of the Aryas. An Arya being somebody who has realized the nature of reality directly. Okay? So four things that a highly realized Sangha has realized directly and sees as true. So the third chapter, we all know, Four Noble Truths, Dukkha, the origin of Dukkha, its cessation, and the path. Okay? Within the path, all about three higher trainings. Yeah? The higher training in ethical conduct, higher training in concentration, higher training in wisdom. So the next three chapters are about those three higher trainings. One chapter talking about ethical conduct and the precepts. One chapter talking about concentration and how to cultivate shamatha. And a third chapter about wisdom, talking about how to cultivate vipassana. Then, following that chapter on wisdom, there's another chapter about selflessness and emptiness. Yeah? Because selflessness, of the three characteristics, impermanence, dukkha, and selflessness, it's the third one, and it talks about the nature of reality. So there's a whole chapter about that. And then we go into dependent arising, or dependent origination, which is also taught in all the Buddhist traditions. Sometimes we talk about it in terms of the 12 links of how we get born in cyclic systems and how we can stop rebirth in cyclic systems. Other times we talk about dependent arising as everything causal, everything that functions depending on a cause, about things being established in relationship to each other, and also about things existing by being merely designated and conceived. Okay, from there we go into how to unite shamatha and vipassana. Okay, that comes in all the traditions. Then chapter 12 is about progressing on the path. So both traditions lay out how we progress, what realizations we get at what time on the path. And then we go into a section on the four Brahma Viharas, or it's also called the four immeasurables. So how to cultivate love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. Okay. Those again are common to all the Buddhist traditions. After that is a chapter on bodhicitta, the aspiration for full awakening. And what many people don't know is that in the Theravada tradition, there is a teaching on bodhicitta, and there is the description of the bodhisattva path. Many people don't know that, thinking that only exists in the Mahayana traditions. It doesn't. Okay? So there's a chapter about bodhicitta, and then there's a chapter about, in Pali it's called the paramis, in Sanskrit the paramitas. So those are the bodhisattva practices. So both the Pali tradition and the Sanskrit tradition, they talk about 10 bodhisattva practices, but they also say that everybody should do these practices. Okay? The list of 10 differs a little bit in the two traditions, but actually the material covered in them is the same. They overlap. Then there's a chapter about the possibility of full awakening and Buddhist and Buddha nature. So that's something that many people are interested in nowadays, how all of us have the potential to become a fully awakened Buddha. And then the last chapter is on Tantra, which is practiced in Japan and also in Tibet and Mongolia. And so trying to clear up some misunderstandings about Tantra. So that's what the book is. You have to read it very slowly because
I gave it to a friend of mine who is a monk in Thailand. And he read it, and he told me that he learned more about Theravada Buddhism from this book, which I thought was quite interesting, that he learned about his own tradition. Okay, so what I'd like to do now is open it for questions and answers, and let you ask what is of interest to you.
It may not be a difficult question for Venerable, but I observed that you did mention about the four noble truths, which is equivalent to the infinite truth about the earth and the universe. The four noble truths
is
equivalent to the infinite truth about the universe. It's a fact that no one can deny about the four noble truths, for example, the suffering, and all of this. And coincidentally, they say that there are four important elements in the universe that also affect human beings, and that is the fire, the earth, the water, and air. Why is there a coincidence of four elements in the universe and then you have the four noble truths?
I've never heard a correspondence between the four truths and the four elements.
Except four.
Four, there's four immeasurables.
And
four establishments of mindfulness. There's many sets of four different things.
Four are also the fact of the universe.
Yeah, if you like, you know, there, if you talk about the universe in the traditional Indian way of those four elements, then there's that. You can also talk about the universe in terms of the modern scientific way.
Yeah. And it's, they also say that the body consists of the four basic elements.
Yeah.
And this is my observation. A very funny question.
Yeah, I've never heard of any correlation between them.
No correlation?
If there is one, I've never heard of it. Like I said, there's also the four establishments of mindfulness, there's the four immeasurables, there's the four strivings, there's many sets of four. In fact, if you like lists, Buddhism is the religion for you. We have lots of lists. Four this, three that, five this, eight this.
But the law of rolling through, any interesting insight?
I was just thinking, three traditions of Buddhism, they are actually quite different. So, would you say that a practitioner of a certain tradition should actually stick to that tradition instead of meshing up all the other traditions? How would you say?
I think things that should be very individual. First of all, it may take someone a while to figure out which tradition to practice. In my particular case, I didn't even know there were different Buddhist traditions. All I knew was I saw a flyer. These people were teaching a meditation course. I went. What they said made sense. I kept going back. That was it. Other people, they know, oh, there's so many different kinds of Buddhism. I want to try this. I want to go here. I want to go there. You know, other people, you know, so they want to try many different things. Other people, you know, maybe the first or second thing they go to, it's like, oh, this feels really good and comfortable, I'm going to stick with this. So I think finding your principal tradition can depend on, you know, the style of the teachings, the
style of the meditation.
It could also depend on the spiritual teacher that you need,
because you want somebody that you really connect with as a spiritual teacher.
So it's going to be different for every person.
And then some people start with one tradition, they practice it for a while, then they feel like, oh, I have some questions that this tradition doesn't go into depth on. I want to see if another tradition goes into depth on these questions. And so they may add on to their original practice by studying in another tradition too. So that's fine. What I don't recommend is being like a kid in an ice cream store that wants to taste all the flavors. Okay? And so the kid takes a little bit of many kinds of ice cream, but they never really eat anything. So that's like a person who, you know, Monday night they go to this, Tuesday night that, Wednesday night this, Thursday here, Friday there, Saturday there, Sunday there, next Monday to another Buddhist tradition, another Tuesday to another time. They go all around, but they never practice anything. So you want to avoid that. Okay?
So, especially if we settle on the tradition, we stick with the tradition. Especially if we find the tradition that's suitable for us,
yeah,
we stick with the tradition.
Yeah, we can stick with that tradition.
Yes. Yeah.
If there's something that's suitable, go with it.
The basis of my question was because meditation in the Theravada tradition is actually quite different from Tibetan tradition, which involves visualization and Theravada tradition is actually we are not supposed to visualize or to catch on to anything. So that's, I think, there's a main difference between the two traditions, by way of meditation, would you say?
There are differences in meditation, but there's an awful lot of similarity. The method of attaining shamatha is very similar in the different traditions. Okay? They have different delineations of the hindrances and the stages, but the basic method is the same. In the Theravada tradition, you do a thing called reflections, or recollections, recollecting Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, the deities, generosity, ethical conduct, nirvana, death. You know, there's these reflections in Theravada where you actually think about some of the teachings the Buddha gave. These reflections are very similar to, in the Tibetan tradition, what we call the long rim, or the stages of the path meditation. Okay? All Buddhist traditions have vipassana. The way they practice it is a little bit different. Okay? All the traditions, most of the traditions have the four establishments of mindfulness. But you know what? In the four establishments of mindfulness, you do some visualization, because there's a meditation where you imagine all the flesh comes off your bones, and then your skeleton grows bigger and bigger until the whole universe is made of bones. This is in the Theravada tradition. It's done with your imagination. It's visualization. Okay? So, and the way, for example, the Tibetans use visualization, for example, before we take refuge, we visualize the Buddha in front of us. And before you take refuge, you imagine the Buddha in front of you, then it would probably enhance your feeling of closeness to the Buddha. I don't think it would cause any problems. That's my personal opinion. Because for me, there's a difference if I just take refuge and I'm putting it out there into space, and I'm taking refuge and I'm imagining the Buddha. There's a difference. Yeah? When you do the meditation on the four immeasurables or the four Brahma Viharas, that involves some thinking. That involves some visualization. Because you're thinking of a friend, an enemy, and a stranger. You're imagining people suffering. You're imagining them being free of suffering. Okay? So, I don't think we can make hard and fast rules about, or hard and fast statements about some of these things. Okay? But that's my opinion.
And ask one more question. Where would you say the Buddha is now? Where would you say the Buddha is now? Because you see the Buddha not like the other faith. You see Jesus and the believers, helping them or something like that. So how do you Buddhas look at Buddha? The Buddhist look at the Buddha? Where's the Buddha?
People
always ask me this question.
So here you find some different beliefs in the different traditions. In the Pali Suttas themselves, the Buddha isn't real explicit about what happens at Nirvana. Yeah? So when I went to Thailand to do some research for the book, I found that some Buddhists there said that when the Buddha attained Nirvana, he still had this defiled body at that time. So it was called, his Nirvana was called Nirvana with remainder, the remainder being the defiled body. But when he passed away, he left his defiled manifest, and that was called the Nirvana without remainder. And those people believe that since the Buddha eliminated all ignorance, anger, and attachment, that he no longer took rebirth. And so he was, how to say, nirvanized. You know, he doesn't really exist anywhere. Okay. So some people in the Theravada say that. But I also found a whole group of people in Thailand who say that the consciousness continues after you attain the Nirvana. And there is one very well-known Thai yogi from last century, Ajahn Mun, and he had visions of the Buddha and all the arhats. So he concluded the Buddha didn't, the continuity of the Buddha didn't disappear when he attained Nirvana, because he had these visions of the Buddha and the arhats. In the Mahayana tradition, we say that when somebody attains arhatship or Buddhahood, they no longer have the contaminated aggregates that are caused by ignorance and polluted karma. But we say that the continuity of the consciousness continues, so that there is the continuity of Shakyamuni Buddha's mind still continues. And the Buddha can manifest in many different forms, in many different universes, to be of benefit to sentient beings. So there's that kind of idea. So you'll find differences here. separated from ignorance, anger, attachment, all the other defilements, that there's nothing that can cease the continuity of that pure nature of consciousness. Because one moment of consciousness produces the next moment. So that makes a lot of sense to me. Huh? It also makes sense to me that since the Buddha has great compassion for all living beings, that he must be manifesting in different forms in our world to guide us. I can't imagine him attaining nirvana and then saying, forget it. Yeah? So it makes sense to me, yeah, that he would manifest in our world. Of course, the Buddha or Bodhisattva manifesting in our world isn't going to wear a name tag and say, you know, hi, you know, like the name tags that say, hi, I'm Buddha, you know, hi, I'm Kuan Yin, you know. But they could still manifest in these ways to benefit us. Why not?
So she just wanted to clarify, why is it that after the Buddha has attained nirvana, there's still manifestations of the Buddha, like in physical or form?
Okay, so why there's still physical manifestations of the Buddha after he attained nirvana? Okay, some people say there's no physical manifestation. The Buddha's consciousness stopped. Other people say that the Buddha's consciousness continues, and because his consciousness is completely free and has developed all qualities infinitely, that then he can make these different manifestations to be able to benefit us. And we read stories, I mean, even some of the Arhats have these supernormal powers where they could make manifestations. So it's possible. When you have deep samadhi, this kind of thing is possible. Okay. So I also wanted to let you know that if you take a brochure, we have brochures on the back there. We have a YouTube channel with lots of teachings on them that you can watch. And we also have a website with audio teachings and written teachings, so there's a lot of resources for you to follow. Okay. So let's do what I call a digestion meditation. Let's think about what we heard for just a couple of minutes so that you can remember the teachings, and then we'll dedicate. Of this, all living beings can become. completely Buddhist. That our teachers and our sincere practitioners have no lives. We can practice without obstacle. And that the Buddha's teachings in all their different varieties that are suitable for sending beings with so many different dispositions, that all these teachings remain in their form in our realm forever. Precious holy mind, not yet partner of the birth, be that for